Welcome to Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower, a videocast series on arms control, non-proliferation, and related international security issues. I'm Sarah Vidgood, director of the Eurasia Non-Proliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies in Monterey, California.
And I'm Hannah Notte, senior research associate at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation.
Join us as we discuss cutting-edge research and what it means for real-world decision-makers. Whether it's nuclear doctrine, deterrence dynamics, regional challenges, or the state of international regimes, there's just so much to talk about.
And with our guests, we'll break down how their analysis can help us make sense of a complex security landscape.
In each episode, we'll bring Machiavelli into the Ivory Tower.
Thanks for watching. We're glad you're along for the ride.
Welcome to Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower. Our guest today is Scott Sagan, who is the Caroline S. G. Monroe Professor of Political Science, the Mimi and Peter Haas University Fellow in Undergraduate Education, and also a Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute at Stanford University. We are delighted to have Professor Sagan with us today for a conversation about his newest article, The Rule of Law and the Role of Strategy in U.S. Nuclear Doctrine, which appeared in the journal International Security in spring 2021. Scott, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Scott, the article I just mentioned is one that you co-authored with Professor Alan Weiner, who is a professor of law at Stanford. Could you just summarize for us the main sort of thrust of your article and tell us a little bit more about what you see as its primary implications for policymakers?
Well, Professor Weiner and I are trying to revitalize or reinvigorate the scholarly study of nuclear strategy. It's a pretty audacious and important goal, I think, but scholarship on nuclear strategy has become, in my view, quite stagnant. And that's in the academy. Inside the Beltway, it's become somewhat polarized, and there aren't the next generation of people who are writing really important new work on military strategy and nuclear weapons. So we want to push forward with this. And there are three revolutions that we argue and identify as being really important and make the modern and the future nuclear environment so different than what it was during the Cold War. One is that the United States has both adversaries that have a large nuclear arsenal and have moved towards a first use doctrine like Russia, and have small adversaries that have vulnerable nuclear forces and very small numbers of nuclear forces like North Korea. Our strategy has to really think through very differently about how to respond in a multi-nuclear world. Second, there's a revolution in yield and accuracy. People used to talk about nuclear weapons as being completely indiscriminate, and large nuclear weapons that were not on accurate delivery platforms were indiscriminate. But today we have both high and low yield weapons, and we have many weapons that have very accurate delivery systems attached to them, very, very accurate. And this leads some people to think that we can used conventional weapons for many of our operations. We need to think about what nuclear weapons we really need and what we need them for, or if we actually need them. So the revolution in yield and accuracy has to be taken into account. And lastly, what we focus on is the third revolution, the legal revolution. When the United States first was negotiating the additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions, we said that these don't apply to nuclear weapons at all. In 2013, however, the United States declared that all our nuclear doctrines, plans, and military operations would abide by the principles of distinction, of proportionality, and of precaution. So what we want is to revitalize the discussions of people analyzing U.S. nuclear strategy to include all three of those revolutions in the way that they're thinking. And we want lawyers to be involved because they're as guilty as some of the political scientists in ignoring, for them, the first two revolutions. The strategists have, unfortunately, in so much of their writing, ignored the legal implications. And we want to spell those out. So I'm really happy to be here and talk to you about this revolution in legal thinking that impacts American nuclear strategy in ways that was inconceivable when I worked in the Pentagon many, many years ago.
Thank you, Scott. That's so thought-provoking. And I want to pick up on something that you mentioned towards the tail end of your response to my first question there, which is this decision in 2013 on the part of the US government to bring its nuclear war plans into consistency with the fundamental principles of the law of armed conflict. And I'm curious to hear if you have any insight or sort of what your thoughts are about perhaps what was behind this decision, especially in light of the impact of those principles on US nuclear doctrine if properly applied. So I wonder what you think about that.
It's a really good question, Sarah, and it's a complicated one that's worthy of a whole nother article, really. So as I said, the United States originally said that they don't, that the laws of armed conflict do not apply to nuclear weapons. And in 1987, however, the legal advisor to the State Department representing the United States government, Mike Matheson, announced that even though we had not ratified the additional protocols to the Geneva Convention, it was our position that the major rules, distinction, precaution, and proportionality, were part of customary international law, and that we self-declared that we are bound by those in all of our military operations. Now, he didn't specify nuclear weapons in doing that. And indeed, the chief legal advisor, his boss, in essence, Abe Sofair, Judge Abe Sofair in the Reagan administration, announced that the United States did not consider reprisal against civilians to be illegal under a pretty obscure but important legal principle called belligerent reprisal. So that's where things stood in the 1980s. And when I worked in the Pentagon very briefly in the 1980s, I went from the literal ivory tower of Harvard to a windowless room in the basement of the Pentagon and began working on nuclear strategy issues. And we didn't have a JAG lawyer looking over our shoulder all the time. But today, JAG lawyers, judge, advocate, general lawyers are all over the US military as we've gradually integrated the thinking about the laws of armed conflict. Now, Professor Weiner and I are not saying that we think the US government always gets it right, but we are saying that they take it very, very seriously. And it would behoove us in the academy to recognize that, for better or for worse, the military pays enormous attention to this today, whether in the nuclear space or the non-nuclear space. An additional point I think is worth making here is that the 2013 statement was quite fulsome in both outlining the nature of the rules that we would follow, and specifically said that the United States would not target civilians or civilian objects. That has been known for a long time. Just recently, in the last few months, the Trump administration's guidance was released. And it most interestingly said the United States will not target civilian population, but did not say civilian objects, which could include a food factory or a hospital, for example. And so there's still a debate about belligerent reprisal. Our position is that the rule that the argument that the US does not accept the principle of the illegality of belligerent reprisals against civilians has become outdated. And indeed, the United States, because we have not been a persistent objector, now is obligated because that law has become part of customary international law. And that's what we're recommending that the government acknowledge. When we talk about responses, you'll see that at least some people from the Trump administration agree with us and some people disagree with us.
Thank you for that, Scott. And let me come in here for a second. Let's talk a little bit about the reception of your piece. You already just mentioned the Trump administration I believe you've been quite active in recent months, sort of talking about your article at various fora. What has been the reaction to your findings and to the arguments that you put forward about how the laws of armed conflict would properly apply to nuclear doctrine? What has been the reaction from different corners and constituencies?
It's been fascinating. It's almost like a Rorschach test. Different people react very, very differently. One high-level former official said privately that if you take into account the principle of precaution, that you should use the lowest yield necessary or switch to conventional weapons if they can attack a target effectively, you will reduce collateral damage. I said, yeah, that's why we would want to do it. And he said, pointedly, well, if you reduce collateral damage, you'll weaken deterrence. And my response to that is twofold. One, if you're using collateral damage for the sake of deterrence, it's no longer collateral. It's deliberate and illegal. And second, I am by no means convinced. I think this is a researchable topic that reductions in collateral damage, I'm not convinced it weakens deterrence. I think it can actually strengthen deterrence by making it seem more likely that you would respond in kind to an attack, or that you respond appropriately to an attack. In this regard, I think Bob Kaler, the former STRATCOM commander, has it right when he argued in his Daedalus article a number of years ago, that if you ever make a military option arguably illegal, you actually reduce an adversary's perception that you might actually implement it, because there'd be a chance that the military would say, no, sir, we're not going to implement that. So I think the law and deterrence are really, really interesting questions and need a lot more research. There have been two other kinds of responses. In the current issue of international security, five former administration officials respond to us. John Harvey, Frank Miller, Keith Payne, and Brad Roberts object to our statement that when they said, and I'm paraphrasing, you can look it up if you want to get the actual quote, they said that the United States Trump administration statement that we hold open the option of using nuclear weapons in response to a cyber attack or a non-nuclear strategic attack that killed many Americans or allied population was just a clarification of past positions, and that the American public would want no option taken off the table. They now say that they have, when they were in power, done everything possible to make sure that the United States plans do not include a potential to attack against civilian population, even in reprisal. To us, that's actually a very important statement to have four senior officials state that. That's a far clearer position than any US government statement in a nuclear posture review has made. And indeed, we have recommended elsewhere, not in that article, but in some spin-off pieces, that the United States government in the new NPR should do exactly that and say that we will not attack civilian populations, even in reprisal. There are many other things that you can do if someone attacks your population, but deliberately killing civilians is illegal if you're doing it in a deliberate way. And we think we should be more direct about it. For the record, we note in our response to Harvey et al. That the part of what we object to was their statement that the American public would want no option taken off the table. They say, well, look, we're just citing your own work, the work that Ben Valentino and I have done that shows the American public is really hawkish. And we know, yeah, that's probably true, but there are options that should be taken off the table. And that they, by posing, I don't know why they put those two sentences together, but it was as if the second one was a way of trying to add a little oomph of deterrence by stressing the American public's hawkishness. And to our mind, that is very similar to what James Baker did in 1991 when he told Tariq Aziz that if you use chemical weapons, the American public would demand vengeance. This is not a threat, this is a promise, he said. And that's a pretty common thing to do if you're making a threat that is arguably illegal, to say somebody else is going to make us do it rather than try to make a more legal threat. We should respond if anyone attacks our population vigorously and use a very strong response. But to kill an enemy set of civilians deliberately seems to me both illegal and immoral. So that's one set of responses. In the same issue, a former State Department senior official, Chris Ford, who is also a lawyer, although he was not serving the government in a legal capacity, he was a political appointee, argues the opposite of Harvey et al. By saying that, of course, the United States holds open the right to use nuclear weapons against civilians and deliberately kill civilians, and claims that we have been a persistent objector in our statements about this, and cites a 2010 Army desk book on the law of war that makes a statement going back to that 1987 response of Abe Sofares. And when I first read Ford's response, I said, boy, I thought I had read all the law books about this. And that's why we could say we haven't been a persistent objector. And what Ford failed to tell his readers was that that law book begins with the caveat in the very beginning of the book saying that nothing in this book reflects the official position of the US government. And so he's actually, I think, really misleading the readers, and that we stand by our position that the United States has not been a persistent objector. That's one set of arguments. There's been, I think, less from the minimum deterrence advocates that we criticize, but I know that Steve Fetter and Charlie Glazer at Maryland and at George Washington University, respectively, are writing a response about the illegality legal but lethal, an argument against counterforce, because while some people are criticizing us for trying to constrain the US government, others are saying no, by saying that counterforce can be legal if it is proportionate, which it can be under certain circumstances. That's a legal use of nuclear weapons in our view. Other people are criticizing that part of that, but those responses have not yet been published. I look forward to seeing them.
Thank you for that, Scott, for that quite comprehensive overview on receptions, and we'll come back to the nuclear posture review a bit later in the conversation. For the moment, I want to speak about the views of one particular constituency here, and that is the humanitarian impact movement. Now, there's been quite some effort underway in recent years by advocates, for instance, of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, to really buttress the legal prohibition of nuclear weapons themselves, really of the class of weapons. I mean, where I'm sitting here in Berlin, the new German government has just indicated its willingness to possibly observe the States Parties Conference of the TPNW alongside Norway, and some hope that this will sort of give a further push to the TPNW. Now, you say quite clearly in your article that you don't look at that particular intersection between the law and nuclear strategy. So you don't look at sort of the rules that purport to categorically ban nuclear weapons as a class. But let me still ask you this. What do you say to those who would argue that it's ultimately better, more fruitful, farsighted to focus our policy and our scholarly efforts really there on the rules that prohibit nuclear weapons as a class, rather than to spend our time with the legal rules that pertain to their use, which is ultimately very unlikely?
Let me make a few remarks here, Hannah. First, the humanitarian consequences movement, starting in the first meeting in Norway many years ago, did usefully look at issues like the risk of accidents or the laws of armed conflict and the questions about nuclear winter, all these issues that impact us enormously, and then was diverted and moved into the movement to create the ban treaty, the TPNW. I would advocate for that movement to be recreated and be much more diverse in its perspectives, because even if you think that we should eventually outlaw nuclear weapons, we're going to have them for a while, and while we're working on disarmament, and these other questions impact the humanitarian consequences of use and of development. So I think it's unfortunate that people have sort of washed their hands of the bigger issues by saying we're only going to focus on the TPNW. The TPNW, unfortunately, in my view, has really united the nuclear weapon states. You can be a persistent objector. What the TPNW does is makes it illegal for any signatories to the treaty to possess or use nuclear weapons. It has quite inadequate verification measures attached to it, which they did deliberately in order to get more people to sign up. But the nuclear states have and will continue to state that they do not think that this is leading to any customary international law. When the United States wants to be a persistent objector, it knows how to do that. I'd say finally, I hope that the TPNW does not have one of the downside risks that I think it could. And we'll find out very soon in the next NPT review conference. The NPT review conferences have traditionally been about the non-nuclear weapon states putting pressure on the nuclear states to do more on the disarmament side, to do more on the Article 4 sharing of nuclear technology side, in exchange for them accepting more either the permanent extension of the treaty in 95, or extra rules about verification, like the additional protocols for the IAEA. And those trade-offs are part of a bargaining process that happens every time the NPT review conference happens. I'm particularly worried that there'll be fewer incentives for trade-offs in that regard, as people have hunkered down, and some people on the nuclear TPNW have been arguing that indeed we should replace the NPT or withdraw from the NPT. I think that's a really dangerous argument, and it's playing with fire. So I hope that the next NPT review conference goes well and that the TPNW advocates still maintain a willingness to bargain with the nuclear weapon states to try to reduce the role of nuclear weapons, try to reduce the numbers, and have a step-by-step approach towards disarmament.
Scott, this is fascinating, and I hate to divert us from our sort of present line of questioning because I think it's really interesting, but I want to return back to a point that you made earlier in the conversation, which is this intersection between sort of, on one hand, legal approaches to looking at the kinds of questions that you're interested in and academic approaches. And as you pointed out, your co-author, Alan Weiner, is a professor of law and a former attorney. And you are a political scientist. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about sort of how your collaboration came about. What was the genesis of your joint efforts to look at these questions that you're exploring?
Professor Weiner and I agreed a number of years ago to try to teach a class together, a Stanford undergraduate class called The Rules of War, in which we talk about the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, the practice from the 19th century to today. And we realized that there was a lacuna. And when we started teaching on the nuclear issues, I recognize how I thought some of the political science work, the work of Fetter and Glaser that I mentioned earlier, or some of the RAND Corporation studies, or Bruce Blair's efforts to try to develop a lower sized arsenal, totally ignored or misinterpreted the law issues. And he, Alan Weiner, said, well, if you think that's bad, look at the legal literature on this, which assumes that weapons are always indiscriminate and doesn't think about strategy and doesn't think about the dilemmas that a statesman or a senior general would have about how do I destroy this target? How do I make a judgment about whether I can do this with conventional weapons versus nuclear weapons? And so we decided to write together. And you know, lawyers, by their professional training, write these very long footnotes and cite everything. The law review articles are huge. They're like a whole book. And so I give Alan Weiner a lot of credit for letting me take the pen on some of the political science work and to craft it. It was a great collaboration. I hope we're going to continue to teach, and I hope we'll continue to write. It was fascinating also to see international security and their reaction. The reviews were very good, but the managing editor, Morgan Kaplan, said, you'll have to explain to people about the law. Is it okay to be like a little bit legal, or do you have to follow all the rules to be legal? And so we did. So for this, it was a bit of a primer, if you will, about how international law works, because so many of the readers of international security would not buy it. We did have some very senior military people read it and provide comments, and we thank them in the acknowledgments. So the senior JAG for STRATCOM, without endorsing everything in it, gave us extremely helpful comments. And then General Kaler, the former STRATCOM commander, who's got a strong interest, gave very, very good comments as well. So we're still talking about this. I've talked about it in Washington a number of times recently, and we're going to still take it to law conferences as well as political science conferences and hopefully get more responses.
That's great. I'm really happy to hear that, in part because, you know, I obviously am not somebody who focuses on the law in my own work. And so I did treat this as a primer and found it to be really helpful in that regard. I'm sort of interested in this bigger question that you point to in your article about the silos between legal and strategic studies, which picks up on something you were just talking about. And I'm curious to understand what you think sort of the broader implications of such insulations within the disciplines is, and whether you think this is problematic in other areas beyond the realm of nuclear doctrine. What are some potential remedies that people could look to if you do think that that is something that is indeed problematic?
I think that the silos are far less present when it comes to US military operations regarding the war on terror, for example, where people have been writing about drone attacks and the laws of armed conflict for quite some time. It's quite remarkable looking back that President Obama, when he was given the Nobel Peace Prize, actually chose to talk about just war theory and the laws of armed conflict. And he was really, really interested in these things. Indeed, that's part of the answer about what happened in 2013, was that the president really cared about this and wanted to make sure that this was included in all military plans. So I think there's great scholarship out there, work by Nita Crawford or Tanisha Fazal or Jennifer Welsh, all looking at how the laws of armed conflict are utilized, sometimes for bad reasons, how the laws of armed conflict can constrain officials. And you have just in this week's New York Times a whole series about how the rules that Obama had placed on some of the drone attacks during his presidency were loosened in the Trump era, leading to many more civilian casualties in the fight against ISIS. Eric Schmidt has been doing very powerful reporting for the New York Times on this. So I think that lawyers and political scientists need to work together in this area and emulate the work of some of the people who have done such excellent work. Let me add one more point. Are you familiar with the work of Jake Shapiro and Joe Felter in this area?
I am not, and I'd love to hear about it.
So Joe is here at Stanford, a senior research scholar at CSAC. And Jake is a professor in the political science department at Princeton. And they have a very important article in Daedalus a few years ago about how following the laws of armed conflict can help you win counterinsurgency battles. And they make the following point. Joe, prior to coming here, he's a PhD, but was a colonel and was the operator of the, or was the manager of the think tank that we had in Afghanistan and Iraq, serving General McChrystal and General Petraeus. And what he did with Jake Shapiro is to show that when the United States reduced collateral damage in our airstrikes, it actually led to decreases in recruitment to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and it led to local farmers helping the United States by giving us more information about the planning of IEDs. So they make this argument, which I think is really, really important, that following the laws of armed conflict, reducing collateral damage as much as possible, actually can help you win wars. It's contrary to what many people think, but I know that it's a very important body of work.
Thanks for that, Scott. That's super interesting. I do want to bring the conversation a little bit back to what's going on in Washington these days.
Sure.
We are all waiting for the Biden administration to complete and release its nuclear posture review, which you've already mentioned. And as we are waiting, it seems to us that most of the expert debate is really centered on questions like, will there be language on sole purpose or no first use of nuclear weapons? What would be the implications for extended deterrence in the Asian and European theaters? But there's very little debate about the legal dimensions of the nuclear posture review, certainly among the arms control and strategic community. So I want to ask you, what would need to be reflected in the NPR? How would this document need to be different? How would US declaratory policy need to be different to bring it in line with the law of armed conflict?
Yeah, so Alan White and I recommend three specific things in the next nuclear posture review. One would be to clarify the US position on belligerent reprisal against civilians and civilian objects. It's been something that we say that we have not been a persistent objector, but there's no clarification language. So for example, just to say the United States will not intentionally target civilian populations or civilian objects by way of belligerent reprisal makes it clear that that we will not do that, and that is not just declaratory policy, but it's guidance. The NPR is part of what becomes the guidance. And that would be useful. Second, we could say that the United States would not use a nuclear weapon against a permissible military target if that target could be destroyed or neutralized effectively by conventional means. Jeffrey Lewis and I have called this the nuclear necessity principle or the precautionary principle. That I think would be a very valuable thing to add. It would put, you know, one of the important ways the United States can show that we are reducing the role of nuclear weapons is to say something like that, that would tell a commander that if you can neutralize that target with conventional weapons, you must not use a nuclear weapons in your targeting plans. And lastly, I would say, regardless of what we say on extended deterrence and sole purpose, I think the debate, especially, I mean, Hannah, you can tell me whether you see this in Germany or elsewhere in Europe. I think too often what I see in the debate is a people conflate two different things. One is the threat that the United States would use nuclear weapons if our allies are attacked conventionally. And the other is that we would use nuclear weapons in response to our allies being attacked with nuclear weapons. People call both of those extended deterrence, and people call both of them like a nuclear umbrella covers both of those terms. If we move towards no first use or sole purpose, that should be accompanied, therefore, with a commitment that the United States will respond appropriately if anyone uses nuclear weapons against an ally. That would reduce the incentive that allies feel abandoned by what is a movement to reduce the role of nuclear weapons and would seek their own.
Thank you for that, Scott. And we have now talked about the commanders and the generals a fair bit. And so I do want to probe you a little bit on the practical applicability of your findings. I mean, thinking of situations in which the United States might consider the launch of nuclear weapons, it seems to me sort of intuitively that there will always be very little time to thoroughly think through the law of armed conflict dimensions of any given scenario. And as you yourself note in the article, and I quote you here, this places a great burden on a commander's knowledge of the law and personal judgment under stress. So can you talk a little bit more about how practitioners, both you know, on the military side, but perhaps also officials, could put your findings to use, how your research can concretely help them?
Very good question, Hannah. Let me say that first off that options that have been placed into the president's football, the set of options, they have already been vetted by senior lawyers, and the targets on them have been deemed to be legitimate military targets. The question about proportionality means that they consider the destruction of those targets with particular weapons is not disproportionate, which is what the rule says. So you can have collateral damage. It can't be disproportionate to the importance of destroying that particular military target. So for vetted plans, I think they already exist. The real question here happens if the president is trying to do something in a very limited way that hasn't been thought through in advance. And there, I think it is true that the president might say, I don't care, I want you to do this anyway. So imagine that there's a terrorist attack coming from a ISIS-controlled area in Syria and kills lots of Americans. If the President of the United States said, I want you to use a nuclear weapon and destroy that city, I believe that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the STRATCOM commander should tell him in no uncertain terms that, sir, that's illegal. And we are duty bound not to follow that order. And if told you do it anyway, then they would say, sir, we will not do that. If the president said, I want to use a nuclear weapon against a isolated target in the middle of the desert somewhere, or one that was a chemical weapons plant that could create collateral damage, but nonetheless, it was deemed that the judgment would be that it would save more lives than it would kill, I think the commander would say, sir, yeah, we have to do that. That's following the rules, unless they could say, well, sir, here's a conventional option that could do the same thing and it could destroy it and it would have less collateral damage. And if the president says, I want the collateral damage, then the officer would be obligated to say, sir, that's illegal. We are bound to take feasible precautions. We're not bound to not attack something, but we have to take feasible precautions. And it's our judgment that we should not move forward with that. Now, when I talk about this, sometimes people say, well, boy, that's fanciful. What president would order illegal acts? And I'd like to remind people, we had, after the Soleimani assassination, President of the United States, President Trump, said that we're going to attack 52. If there's a response from Iran, we're going to attack 52 sites, one for each hostage that Iran took many years ago, and that they will include cultural heritage sites, important cultural heritage sites. And to their credit, the military, and in this case, Secretary of Defense Esper, said, we're not going to do that. And said, we will follow the laws of armed conflict. So I think it's important. One last point, Hannah, for your consideration here is, I think that the senior military officers in a crisis really will be tested about their knowledge. And that's why it's important to have a senior lawyer with them all the time. There were interesting military exercises. War games would be the better way of putting it, because they weren't actual forces moving. In 2016, when the principals, this is all from Fred Kaplan's excellent book, The Bomb. Kaplan reports that the deputies, the number two ranking people in the National Security Council, were given a scenario in which Russia used a single nuclear weapon against a military base in the Baltics in a conventional conflict. And they chose to launch a conventional response against the base from which the nuclear weapon had been launched against NATO. The principals then reran the war game, and they said, no, we have to respond with nuclear weapons, and wanted to respond slightly with larger numbers. When they did that, they were told by intelligence that the Russians would consider an attack with nuclear weapons against their homeland as an attack by the United States, because it would be, requiring under their doctrine a nuclear response against the United States. So the principals shifted the target plan to target Belarus instead of Russia. And how a nuclear attack against Belarus was meant to add credibility to our deterrent, and it was left unsaid. So I think even at the highest levels of government, sometimes people haven't thought through these dilemmas accurately. And I would note that there were no JAG lawyers in any of those war games. So one thing that Alan Weiner and I proposed is that when we have exercises in war games, you need to have senior lawyers there to help policymakers think through these issues.
Scott, I'd like to finish up with one final question here that I think teases at a number of the threads that have already come through in our conversation. Samuel Moyne, who is a law professor and a history professor at Yale, has a new book called Humane: How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. And in it, he's essentially tracing the United States' efforts to make war more legal and thus, in effect, sort of sanitize and perpetuate it. And in part of his book, he cites Leo Tolstoy, who worried that, and I'll quote here, humanitarianism could entrench war by rendering it more palatable. And so I'm curious what you would argue to those who say that explicating how the use of nuclear weapons can be brought into accordance with the law of armed conflict would actually render the use of those weapons more palatable.
Sarah, Samuel Moyne's book is profound, but I think also profoundly wrong on a number of points. He points out that IHL, international humanitarian law, can entrench warfare by making it more palatable. But what made it more palatable was, for the American public, was not IHL. It was the creation of a volunteer army so that most Americans don't have any skin in the game, don't even know anybody in the military unless you're from the South or from one of the families that have had generations of people, you know, in the US military. So it's not IHL itself, it's been the structure of the military that has produced that. And second, I think what has entrenched war is not IHL, it's that we have international terrorism that has required that the United States, or has led the United States, to fight both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but then elsewhere, because international terrorists will take their acts to their grievances against the United States and lead them to attack Americans. So I think the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols of Geneva Conventions have been a real achievement, and that the American military's acceptance of them does create risks, but the risks can be managed. As much as I like Tolstoy, I think the idea that we should ban war is not going to happen. And Tolstoy himself, at least Tolstoy through his discussions of Prince Andrei in War and Peace on the battlefield of Borodino, shows the consequences of ignoring the laws of our conflict, where he says, well, we shouldn't take any prisoners. We should kill all the French. They're horrible. The first laws of humanitarian law in the original Geneva Conventions was to at least stop us feeling like we could execute prisoners, because they're even though they're no longer a threat. And that was the first major step. But other steps include the outlawing of aggression war and creating just war doctrines, and moving gradually through the additional protocol to these other principles. I think war is always going to be with us. And that as long as it is, it behooves us to take the law seriously. We would not, I hope, and we didn't, like during the Vietnam War, execute Vietnamese prisoners because of the way the North Vietnamese were treating our prisoners of war. And it's time that we take that principle to its highest level by saying we won't deliberately kill civilians, even if an adversary deliberately kills ours.
Scott, what a way to end this video cast. I think you've given us and the audience a lot of food for thought. Thank you so much for these thorough and thoughtful reflections on the relationship between nuclear doctrine and the law of armed conflict, and for, in fact, being our first guest in Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking with you both today.